Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. Well, please go ahead and introduce yourself to give some context to our conversation.
Certainly, my research is in cognitive neurology, but in terms of how I got here, I was a professor at the University of Nebraska, and along the way, I ended up using assessments to help my students understand self, because that's another sidebar, but frankly, none of us really understand self as well as we should, and if we did, I think we'd all be better off. And in the process, then, of trying to use assessments to help people understand self, they were questioned because they are self-reports. So then I went down a tangent trying to figure out if they're self-reports, can I triangulate this in some manner to prove that what people put on paper, if they're honest, it's accurate, which led then down this road to creating brain images that are able to actually almost serve like a lie detector to prove that, in fact, there is a correlation between what you say truthfully and what comes out of the brain.
Yeah, it's amazing where psychology's at. You answer a bunch of questions, not many, and then it can profile you. And so what you're saying, if you answer them honestly, the outcome is profiled pretty accurately. But then how did you prove that with imaging or the science that you worked on?
That's fascinating in itself. You run into people like you. I run into somebody, and then all of a sudden a conversation leads to something else. And a gentleman by the name of Tom Calora out of Cleveland and I started having a conversation about whether we could see this in the brain. And we studied it. He's president of BrainMaster, which is a supply company for neurofeedback. But we ended up doing a study that proved that, in fact, if you looked at gamma activity, and gamma activity is a very fast wave. People have heard of beta and alpha and so on, but this is a wave that's not been studied very much. And in the process, we found that this wave activity was a precursor to decision-making. In other words, we had this major shift here that was really identifying the emotional load before you even had a cognitive thought. And we could see it in a brain image. And what was really cool was that this brain image actually identified whether you agreed or disagreed. And it showed up differently in the prefrontal cortex. I literally can show you an image of a gamma flare and tell you whether it's left hemisphere, yes, I agree, right hemisphere, no, I disagree. And then the intensity of that flare tells me how emphatic you are about the decision. So it's not only direction, it's intensity.
Wow. So that just, is there like portable devices we all can carry around ourselves to understand if someone's being truthful with us or aligned with us? Is that happening or?
I don't think it's happening, but I will tell you that we have having conversations with a number of agencies about the protocols because they really do work. One of the first things we do when we have a client is unbeknownst to them, we flash their name on the screen. And then we flash later on their name spelled incorrectly. And the brain immediately says, no, that's wrong.
Wow. So you get that baseline. You know, there is some recent books, or maybe not so recent anymore, but like where we don't have free will. Like before we even had thought or made a decision or processed information, our brain was reacting to that. Do you have any thoughts around that? Free will and the processing of decision-making?
I think it's a sad commentary, and actually, it probably needs more conversation than what we can have today. But my research, first of all, as I said earlier, the gamma activity is a precursor to your decision. It's actually telling you the emotional association that you may have with this decision. And sadly, about 95% of the time, when I see that emotional load, it ends up being your final decision.
Wow.
In other words, it appears that you're spending more time rationalizing and justifying the emotional decision than actually logically thinking about your decision. It's a knee-jerk reaction.
So are you saying like you have like this processing in your brain that you're trying to formulate an opinion or a decision, and then what always leave the, it's so weighted to the emotional connection. That's usually your outcome. But what about the logic of it? Can't logic override some emotional decision? Or
yeah, it can. If you stop and realize that I may have actually made an emotional decision, I may actually have bias in my brain, and I have to have evidence for my decision. If you actually do that, you may then actually alter how you feel and what you decide. I'm saying that the vast majority of us don't stop and go through that process.
Yeah, I think some of us learn the hard way of making bad decisions emotionally. And then you're like, yeah, I better like sleep on that, or I better get other people's opinion or think that through a little bit more. That's like what you've been able to scientifically identify.
Absolutely. I find it fascinating how many of us are really not as aware as we think we are about how we make decisions. And I have to tell you, there are certain issues that I have strong opinions about that issue, and I can't tell you where it came from. I don't know why I feel that way. I don't know why I take that stand, but I know it's my stand.
I've learned personally with no scientific data that I have to always trust my gut. It's like there's two things, like intuitively making a decision and then gut decisions, which are just like these definitions of, I believe in those, but is there science behind that? I don't ever go against them now.
Yeah, I think as we age, we start to realize and learn more about how we make our decisions. And I do believe that there is this, we call it an intuition. A neurologist would simply call it a precursor to the decision and the emotional load associated with the decision. So it's a precognition. So the precognition is a gut level feeling.
You know what I don't understand is there's got to be something deeper. Somehow logic or information or experience got processed, and then you made your decision on that, but then you don't know why. I don't understand why you don't know why. Do you have any research like, okay, I don't know why I made that decision, but it's such a strong feeling, intuition that I've learned to go with it. But it's got to come from like some knowledge and experience, right? Or is it DNA? Is it just from like prior? What is that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And what we're differentiating here, and if I can just throw some vocabulary on it, we're talking about symptoms. In other words, the decision is a final decision. It's a symptom of what's going on, but we don't know the cause. And
yeah.
So what you're requesting here is that we go deeper and get back into the causes. In a psychology setting, many times they would be exposing what's called post-traumatic stress. In other words, even a post-traumatic stress is a reaction a person has, but rarely does anyone take and dig deep into why that occurred. What was the stressor originally that laid this path down for you? And so I think we may not want to call what we have post-traumatic stresses, but we had some experience that has led us down this path.
Yeah, I tell you, because we're just part of tech and AI is neural networks making decisions, probabilistic decisions, and it's ruthless in whatever, however it was trained to perform goals. And there's this missing piece of emotion. And I'm just making a hypothesis here without any real knowledge. Like, there needs to be some sort of emotion built into these AIs so that it's keeping things grounded. Do you have any thoughts about that? Like, I don't know if I'm just talking out of left field here, but It just can't be probabilistic neural network decision tree. There's another aspect here that needs to come in.
That they do need to come in, but now you and I would differ as to how we're going to get there. I think that is the element that still makes us part of the formula. I'm not convinced that I want to A, give up that power to AI, and B, I'm not convinced AI can do it. But I do think that's how we fit together, that as a unit, AI is so powerful for doing the things you just described. It is able to make decisions and process data and come up with nuances that would take us years to really factor all of those components. At that time, though, it's like data in Stargate or Star Trek. It doesn't have that missing component that makes it human and makes it applicable in humanity. That's where we add.
This may not be your research. AI takes so much brain power or energy, and then our brain can process so much with so little energy. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts around that. How is that possible?
One of the things that our brain has the ability to do is to recalculate and redefine what information is needed to make a decision. In other words, we really don't look at all the data. We make some major decisions right away, and we focus in, and our brain focuses in. There's some lovely experiments that show just how focused a human brain can be. When you unfocus, there are things going on that were so obvious, but you didn't see it because you were focused on a different component. They're throwing a basketball back and forth. This was 20, 30 years ago. They have this video of about six people. Some have black t-shirts, some have white t-shirts. They're throwing a basketball back and forth. And the question is, how many passes are made during this interaction? So you're focused on one pass, two pass, three pass, and nobody notices the gorilla walking across the screen and banging on his chest and walking off. It is so obvious.
I've experienced that one the first time where I didn't notice it. Then after they tell you, of course you notice it, but I've done it years later and I didn't notice it again. But how does that work? Like, how does the brain, like, how is it able to go to a certain area with the right amount of data and focus? Is there any knowledge around that or research?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's some fascinating things that are going on. The brain, this is one of the attributes of a human brain that is crucial because, again, there is too much data and we have to learn to focus. And the human brain has learned how to do that when it's working correctly and normally. Now, when it's not working correctly, there's an abnormality, information of some kind. And in one example would be ADHD, ADD, some of these things where they can't really focus on the data and they see it all. And they see too much. And the data just flows in with way too many. I remember reading a book many years ago where this young man was trying to describe his world compared to others. He said, I'm riding in a car and you look off to your right and you see a pasture with cows and trees. When I look off to the right, I see seven cows facing toward the trees and eight pacing away from the trees. And he said, I'm just overwhelmed every time I look at anything.
How do we filter that? So he saw a lot more detail than maybe I would have seen.
Yes.
But then how do we how does the brain filter?
Well, how it does it is the magic of being human. And so without getting into a lot of details, it simply goes with zeros and ones and starts focusing in and starts removing, and it's removing massive amounts of data. And look at visual. Just think about a visual cortex for a moment. You're going to look at something and immediately you focus in on what it is you want to see. And I'll tell you, all of us that drive vehicles and cars know that can be detrimental because you didn't see the car coming because you were focused on something else.
Yeah, no doubt.
That's how accidents occur. And actually, when you're really tired, it even focuses in farther. When you're stressed, it focuses in even farther. And so we become myopic when we are not in a good place.
So do you think, I wonder, does the science or your point of view, like free will, it bothers me that I feel like we need to have free will, but is it true we don't have free will? I mean, because that's part of like agency. It's like, I am who I am because of the way I think. And do you have any thoughts around that?
Yeah, I think it's important for each of us to believe we have free will.
Yeah, me too. Otherwise, what's scary? I can reflect on enough situations where, presented with certain questions, certain environment, certain things, I behave the same way. And others behave the same way with me. It's like we are like executing the same patterns.
Yeah,
And it's not free
we see
will.
these
Like,
moves.
or yeah, it's like, what is
Well, and I think there's some advantages, frankly, with age that we can start to reflect back on some of our behaviors. And I journal, and it's scary to go back and start to see the patterns of interactions and the loops that I have actually created in my life, where at the time I didn't recognize that I was actually reliving a loop and reacting in the same way over and over. But only upon reflection did I start to see that, which what I'm really saying is I think each of us need to be far more reflective. My wife would tell you that's her job to help me be reflective.
it's, I don't want to make a generalization, if it seems like women are a lot more in tune, or maybe it's just partner. Your partner's more in tune to your behavior than maybe sometimes you are. I find that true. And I don't know, is there science behind that? Is that
There really is. I'm writing a book right now that'll come out this fall, and each chapter ends with a section that's called The Third Eye, The Lessons I Didn't Know I Was Learning.
huh?
And the third eye, it would be like having a camera in the corner of the room that is identifying a context that you are not aware of. I think a spouse and friends are a third eye many
Yeah.
times if we would listen to them.
And so why does the mind do that? Is that with focus, or like, why is it blindsided like that?
Again, the vast majority of us have not really capitalized on the ability to think beyond the first person and to really be able to see the world differently. We've all encountered people that have this ability. We're in awe when we've encountered somebody that seems to see things that we never saw, to interpret things that we don't aren't able to interpret. It's so exciting, and yet learning how to do it eludes me.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a thing going that's happening even right now in AI where, it has memory. So it's understanding your context in the world, your writing style, you what matters to you, your approach to business, what business you're in. And then it blends all that knowledge in future answers. And so I'm just wondering, if you have a, will AI help us have our third eye, or does it have, like, what do you think about that?
No, I think it can have. I don't recall the exact chapter, but I play with AI every day. It's a part of my lived life. I can't do without it. So I was writing a chapter for someone else's book, and I just, for the fun of it, ran this through. I can name what it was. I used the Google Notebook LM,
Yeah.
and I asked it to write a podcast and create a podcast about the significance of this material. And in that podcast, it identified three patterns. I only spoke of two. It
Nice.
found another pattern in my chapter that I had not seen. And I was so excited to think that just putting that stuff in there did something that I myself missed.
So I'm curious, like, from your point of view, so you've studied the brain in a science way for so long, and now you're firsthand experiencing AI. Do you see any, oh, there's a huge opportunity here for AI research to improve, or oh, that. Like, what are your reflections on your own background and then what your experience is with AI?
I'm looking forward to the AI maybe being this third eye that is more open to all possibilities and more inclusive, because I think each of us are not inclusive. Because, in fact, you come back to your term, you talking about free will. I'll give you actually a better explanation. Free will, I still question, but I can tell you right now that free won't is a major part of every one of us. In
Yeah,
other
well,
words,
yeah, free
what
will.
we don't want is crystal clear. What we don't like is crystal clear. I'm convinced that AI may open that up so that we actually are seeing things that we ourselves have filters and bias that are not allowing us to see.
Yeah, that's great. Now, I love reading about science and stuff, but I'm certainly a novice. And I thought it was interesting that your research is around brain waves. And is it considered sound or energy? Or what are some of the things you could, what can you share about that? Which is, I guess you use imaging and you use brain waves or sound. Like, what, let me, can you like
Yeah,
talk about
let me
that?
describe it a little bit to a layman terminology. I think we've all been aware of EEG, electroencephalograph, which is nothing more than putting electrodes on your head and picking up and magnifying the electrical output that's occurring inside your brain. And there are a number of systems that do this, but the EEG is nothing more than being able to penetrate and pick up what's going through the skull. And if you have enough of these electrodes in place, you can start to triangulate and actually identify vector analysis and where it's occurring within the brain. So you end up getting these images that are actually showing you when there is electrical activity. In addition to where the activity is occurring, you can start to break it down into defined networks of frequencies. And you work from delta, theta, alpha, beta, gamma. All of those are defined numbers of frequencies. And the fastest is gamma, and I work from 38 to 42 hertz. In other words, cycles per second. But when we're sleeping, we've got a lot of theta, we got a lot of delta. And then when we're thinking, right now, I'm hoping this audience is deep into beta and high beta. They're thinking about possibilities. And then if they go off task and they get bored with what you and I are saying, they're going to go back to theta and delta.
That's just brain energy conservation.
Right. That's right.
And what about, are we close to going from either through imaging or what you just described to like, how do you associate that with information, thought process? What are they thinking? What are they doing? How are they processing that? Are we getting close to that or?
We are getting closer than most people are even aware. There are projects underway right now that are taking brain activity. They're training that. In other words, they set up and they gather the EEG that I'm talking about, and they run a client through a given set of scenarios where they actually are able to say that he's looking at a train. And so then they train this AI as to what the brain looks like when you see a train. And all of a sudden, after this training occurs, you can hook this up and you can literally see through the AI what the brain is thinking about and what it's looking. And it's creating real visions of what's going on in the brain.
Now, is that universal from
No.
every? Okay, so if
Right
I'm
now,
thinking about a train and you're thinking about a train, it's not the same pattern matching.
it's not. It's not. And that's the crucial component. You've hit on the problem right away because you see, we don't really know where memories are stored. And in fact, every time you recall a memory, it gets restored in a different place. So the complexity of the human brain is pretty immense.
I mean, how come we're not further along? It's like we made such
Well,
scientific advancements, and then we're living with this for so long, our own brain, and we don't understand a lot, it sounds like.
I think we understand it really two ways to look at that. You're looking at what we're not aware of and what we don't have. I, on the other hand, have been playing in this field for about 30 years, and I cannot tell you how exciting the changes have been
So
and how
yeah,
much more we
summarize that.
know.
That would be interesting. Summarize what do we know and what are some of the recent breakthroughs in the last 5 years?
A couple of things that, see, we've only been talking about EEG right now. Throw into that the fact that you have biofeedback occurring that are the body functions that are changing that correspond to this. They're slower, but we have heartbeat and breathing and other galvanomic components that can be gathered from biofeedback that are also part of this living body that's part of decision making and part of the emotional loads that we're all going through. In addition to that, we've got all these hormones. Paul Zak would be a lovely person for you to interview at some time. He's actually an economist that went off trying to figure out if economy could be tied to hormonal action of the brain. And he started to study oxytocin. Oxytocin is probably known in the common literature as the love hormone. In other words, when you have a good experience, it releases oxytocin. And Paul sometimes is referred to as Dr. Love because his work is all about the role of oxytocin. Oxytocin, when it floods our body, we change and we make different decisions. And we have this overwhelming sense of positivity that comes over us because of a hormone.
Yeah, that's complex. That's when you, like, even things in your gut, do they affect how you process information?
Boy, did you just open a can of worms. Everybody thinks of the neurons of a human as being occupied above your shoulders. I'm sorry, we have almost as many neurons around our gut as we do in our brain. And we don't fully understand. In other words, you used the term earlier on, a gut feeling.
Yeah.
See, there may be some real truth in that. In other words, we don't really know the activity of these neurons that are associated around the gut and their role. It's being studied, but it's a brand new field and an exciting field.
Yeah, so that it's working in conjunction with your hormones, your gut, your neurons, and all these things. Now, what about, you've been part of this field for, I guess, 30 plus years. What are some of the new excitement insights that's happened in the last year, last 5 years, something that where we can see, like, where are we at in this whole journey of figuring this out?
I think the brain-machine interface is our future, and I'm excited to see how that plays out. We are seeing some small gains in people that are paralyzed and being able to circumvent the spinal column and get brain activity that's still activating other portions of the body when injuries were occurring. We're getting some exciting things that are going on at that level. We're trying to figure out how to regenerate neurons and how to reactivate neurons. And maybe one of the most exciting things that comes to mind now that I'm talking and it came to me in mid-sentence is the work that's going on in trying to figure out where dementia is coming from and what we can do about it. And we do now, but we are understanding that we've got this protein that is building up around neurons in the brain, and it's shutting down networks with age, and for some people more so than others. How can we get rid of that? We do know from early research that being cognitively active and continuing to be active in learning seems to slow that. And physical activity seems to slow that. We're getting some exciting studies now that are showing that some activities such as slow-paced breathing can actually reduce the buildup of these proteins in the brain. So there's some really exciting things going on that are not requiring billion-dollar machines.
Yeah, that's interesting because, like, you look at what DeepMind did with creating the ability for protein folding, creating an AI for protein folding, which, like, I draw to analogies. Okay, they basically created some good math for scientists to use that then to discover and utilize and figure out different ways to affect the human body. And is there anyone working on that, like, for the brain? Like, how can you simulate with AI or any algorithm, the brain is trying to figure out the brain? Or
we've tried to do that for many years. I'm convinced that we've got to have a new paradigm because the paradigm has been the brain is a computer. So let's apply our paradigm of how a computer works to simulate the brain. And that's working off of a premise of zeros and ones. And I'm sorry, the brain is far more complex than zeros and ones. And so we've got to start with a new paradigm as to how we're going to reconstruct an interface with a human brain.
So what does that mean? That's hard to comprehend. So, like, it's more like, I don't even know how to comprehend that. So because it's like AI is very probabilistic, but yeah, you're saying that it seems like it processes multiple places, more than one input together how does it orchestrate that?
But I think we can. I think with greater time and energy in programming the AI, we'll start to ask it to interface not only the zeros and ones in terms of a neuron charging, reacting and not reacting. We'll start to be able to also put in thresholds for hormone activity, thresholds for neural net activity. We'll keep adding complexity to this and it'll keep building it. Now, that's a beautiful example I'm going to go to Paris next week, and my wife loves museums. So I used AI, and I'll show you the problem. Because right now, what I was just talking about, the brain is very complex. And I
Yeah.
don't, we are at a point where the brain is, where AI is even able to handle all the variables simultaneously. We're building on that. But here is an example where I went into ChatGPT, I'll even mention it, and I said, oh, I have such an exciting idea. Here is my home address in Paris. It's an Airbnb. I want you to take the following 44 museums and identify the best path to get there from my home. And while you're doing it, please identify the name and address of this museum and give me its opening hours, its closing hours, its cost of fees related to entry fee, and in the days that it's closed. I had four or five other things. In other words, this sucker started to work, and 5 hours later, it said, I'm having problems with encoding.
Yeah.
I made it too complex for that system to handle.
Yeah, it's funny because I did the same thing, maybe not as complex, but I love camping and I'm about to take a week trip back to from Florida to New Jersey, and I gave it some parameters, three stops, couple of days. I need a 50 amp hookup and I want to be along this sort of path. But I thought that takes me 4 hours to 6 hours to do myself. And it did it in 10 minutes. And I was like, oh, hey, wait a minute, this is working. But then it miscalculated the distance between stops, like they said it was 3 hours and it was really six. And it never recovered from that. It could never reset it. And yeah, it was like so close, but then so far. And then I had to do it myself.
And I think it's important for your audience to realize right now that AI is not a final answer. It's not a black box. And if you don't know enough about the topic to know when something's wrong, you better not use AI.
Yeah, I agree. You need to vet
It's
it.
got to
It
have
needs a
that check and balance.
collaborator. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll overcome that? Do you think that the
I
AI
do. I do. I
researchers
do think
will
we'll
overcome that?
overcome it.
Yeah.
But right now, I don't trust AI without my knowledge and my human factor overlaying it.
Yeah, saying that's good advice. And what about what breakthroughs do we need for the brain to like computer interface? Like what are some of the things we need to do to really get there to a different level?
We probably have to go to greater computing times and new chips that actually are again operating under a new paradigm, so that they can operate 100-fold faster, 1,000 times faster.
Yeah, like quantum computers are so crazy. Quantum mechanics is so crazy, and it almost implies that there's a million worlds of us executing. Right now, you and I are in a million other worlds doing something close but different. It's like that conceptually is like crazy, but I think it's real. Like the math is showing it, right? Or what's your point of view there? I'm
No,
a lefty
you're
about.
absolutely. Oh, what I'm thinking about is think about how we started this conversation with human beings that are making decisions and walking around like a robot and frankly not aware of themselves. And you're now talking about awareness that reaches a million fold greater level of understanding. Let's go back and try to get the human being to understand themselves, and then we'll work on the rest of it.
Yeah, quantum is crazy. It's getting closer and closer, but maybe that's what we need. I don't know. We build stuff and we don't understand it, which is crazy. A lot of things are bit like even LLMs themselves. We train it and we build it, but we don't actually understand all the detailed workings of it, which is a little spooky.
Yeah, and I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's arrogant to think that I'm going to understand everything that I interface with on a given day. At the same time, giving up that power strikes me as having some ramifications that are very concerning.
Yeah, it is, especially with capitalism involved. So everyone's racing to make a lot of money, and then the safety may not be there, and there's going to be some missteps. I hope nothing big, but probably. But so what didn't I ask you that you want to share with the audience? Any questions or things you want to share?
Again, I think it's very exciting that our research has been able to identify both direction and intensity of decisions, and that it comes right out of the brain. It's identifiable. I can answer your questions without you saying a word by simply looking at your brain reaction. At the same time, I'm also very concerned that I still have absolutely no idea where biases come from and how to alter them. And we live in a world right now that's very polarized, you know, in this country. And I'm at a loss how to deal with that. I'm at a loss how to get these two sides to communicate very effectively.
Yeah, you know what's crazy? No matter how much agency we have and how smart we are, if someone keeps pounding you with the same message day in and day out, it changes your thought process, which is like upsetting. So it's like you can be so smart, so self-aware, but if you hear the same message, whether it's true or not, it affects your thought process. Is
Yeah,
there
it's pretty
science
bad.
around that? It's pretty spooky. Yeah, that's what's happening to us all.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like it either, but that was like just a pattern, like with no scientific evidence, a pattern I see. And
Yeah,
then,
it's an interesting time to live. I think it's an exciting time to live, but I think we do have to have that third eye mentality and step back a little bit and get out of the battle long enough to see the big picture.
Yeah, reflection's important. So when is your new book coming out?
I think September. I just
Oh,
turned
good.
in 31 chapters, so I'm hoping that the publisher won't throw it all back to me.
Oh,
And
good. And
people like
talk.
yeah,
Yeah, go
I'll
ahead.
give you the working title, and I like the title, so I don't think it'll get changed. But the working title is Defined by Moments, Critical Events in One's Life.
Yeah, that I'm looking forward to that book. And if people wanted to follow your research and even know when your book's coming out, how can they get in touch with you?
Two ways. LinkedIn obviously works for all of us. And you had mentioned that I am the director for research and development at Target Training International. And Target Training International has given me the opportunity to create a branch. And so the Mind Science Center is also, and that's all one word, mindsciencecenter.com.
Okay,
And
good.
what we're doing there is we're taking everything that we've been talking about and we're working with clients and using brain activity for professional development.
Amazing. I really love talking to you, Ron, and I can't wait till your book comes out. And yeah, keep up the good work.
And I can't wait to run into you again serendipitously at TED Talk.
We'll definitely see you at TED next year, but
Yep.
hopefully we'll talk sooner than that. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate you being on the program.
And thank you for your time.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen, and if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.